What is going on, everybody? Welcome to A Theology of Hustle. I'm your host, Curry Blanford, and today I'm talking to Keith. So I met Keith at the Christian Alliance for Orphans conference back in May in Kentucky, and I was at the booth for Replanted Ministry, who we do a lot of work for, and this guy comes up and we just start talking, and me and Keith, I think, hit it off, like, right off the bat. I think he would agree with that. But we just hit it off. We had, like, very similar passions. He actually lived for a time in Amarillo, Texas, where I'm originally from. And so we just had this amazing connection. And he was a guy that I was like, I have to get this guy on the podcast. He has such an amazing story of how God has taken him from, you know, a call to vocational ministry and sort of flip that on its head. Like, I think changed what that means to him and what that means Keith even does with his life. And so Keith started out as an investigator for state of Texas and the foster care system. And so he goes into details about, you know, what that sort of life is like. And I think that's something a lot of us don't even understand, how the foster care system necessarily works. So he talks through his history of doing that. And now he is the CEO of Circle of Care in Oklahoma City. And he is been a CEO for about a year. And so we talk about how he's building a culture at Circle of Care and how he is adjusted in the learning curve. And it's just this episode sort of has everything. It has this amazing story and history of vocation, and it has like some really practical hands-on ways we can sort of think about our career and think about orphan care, frankly. As you know, that is something that's very, very important to me. And I'm just going to warn you right now, Keith will rock you in this episode. He absolutely will. Just the cause of the kids from hard places. We talk a lot about foster care. We talk about why kids are in foster care, what we can do to be helping. And there's some real truth in this episode, just about how God's heart is for kids that need the church to be stepping in. And so, yeah, Keith does a great job of talking about all that. You're going to love this episode. He's awesome. We talk about a lot of great stuff. This is my weekly reminder. Go ahead and leave me a rating and review on iTunes if you can. I greatly appreciate that. You can also follow me at Theology of Hustle on Instagram or Facebook, just to stay up with what's going on at Theology of Hustle. Lots of new stuff coming out all the time, and so make sure you're following me there. I'd love for you to share this episode if you can. So if you think about it on social media, go ahead and share this episode. Share about Circle of Care and what they got going on. I think it's important stuff, and yeah, get the word out. So I hope you enjoy hearing from Keith. All right, Keith. Well, thanks so much for jumping on the call with me and chatting a little bit. Excited to talk.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
For sure. Let's just get started here with just having you introduce yourself to everybody.
Yeah, so Keith Howard, President CEO of a group called Circle of Care in Oklahoma, and just, just living out my passion and my faith at the same time, getting the opportunity to kind of mix both together within a professional setting. And just lead a team of people across the state of Oklahoma who are just living on mission and trying to provide help, healing, and hope to kids and families. And so for me, that's an exciting part of my journey. I have a beautiful wife and six kids, four of which we adopted out of foster care. And so just a part of our story that we get to live out every day. And all six of our kids are amazing, amazing little people that I'm privileged and honored to get to be their dad and get to shepherd them and love on them in this season and guide them into young adults. We live here in Oklahoma and just enjoy being around our friends and our family and trying as a couple and individually, how do we live out the gospel? How do we love others? How do we love our neighbor? And how do we really make maximum impact that we can during the short season of life that we've been given?
Yeah, I love it. That's good stuff. Let's start off by taking the sort of vocational journey for Keith, because, you know, it did not start in Oklahoma, working in foster care. Do you mind just talking a little bit about how that transpired?
Yeah, totally. So, man, I felt the call to ministry when I was 14, and I didn't want the call to ministry, honestly. So I told God, no, it's a joke. Give it to someone else. And all through high school, I kind of thought, man, if I'll just, you know, I would volunteer and I would do things at church. I thought, you know, if I do just enough, God will release this from me. He'll be like, all right, you did your part. I'll give it to someone else. And I remember I'd intern at youth groups thinking that would get me out of this deal. And I'd see other interns come from some of the Christian colleges. And you could tell, like, they wanted the call, but they didn't necessarily have the call. And so I even bargained with God. I was like, God, that guy really wants it. But that young lady really, really wants it. Like, give her mine. I don't need it. Like, I don't want to do this. And so, man, I was just kind of a punk and tried my way to manipulate God out of taking the call off of my life. And so really just kind of started that process and finally gave in the end of my senior year and in college and said, hey, you know, if this is really what you want. So I jumped into ministry, moved down to Waco, Texas, doing youth and college ministry and just trying to accept, what did that look like in my life? Is this what it's going to look like? Am I going to pastor? Am I going to work at a church? But it still wasn't like sitting fully there, you know? And so I wrestled with that. I was trying to figure out, what is this? You know, at that time I'm 23, 24, pretty idealistic, thinking, all right, you know, let me show the church how this is supposed to be done. I'm reading about Paul and he's a tent maker. And I'm like, all right. I'm going to show them, like, I'm going to go get a job outside the church, give my salary back. It's going to be amazing. And
right.
I'm going to do this really holy thing, you know? And probably I was really thinking that would help me get out of my call still, probably. And so, man, I stumbled into child welfare, like really just in my self-righteousness. I'm going to go get a job and show the church how to do this. And I walked in the door, not knowing what I was going to do. And I remember my mom talking to me about it one night. She said, Keith, do you know what you're really about to get into? I was like, Mom, it'll be good. You know, I'll do a job, leave it at work, go home at night. She's like, I don't think that's going to happen in your life. And sure enough, man, it was like this holy disruption. Huh. Like God really began just to break my heart for what breaks his. And so as I started out as an investigator, so I was investigating child abuse and neglect.
Oh, okay.
You know, I was seeing it all around me. We had 12 counties outside of Waco that we covered, and it was the rich communities, the poor communities. There was no, it happened everywhere. And so God really just began to break my heart for that and say, hey, man, do you see this? Do you see what's going on in the world around you? And I was like, man, I do. And so he just kept evolving that in me. And the more he evolved that, the more he just began to shape, like, hey, when I called you at 14, you thought it looked like wearing a suit and preaching on a Sunday morning, and that's what you were running from. But really, I was calling you into this life of ministry to my people.
Wow.
To the ones that people forget about, to the ones that the church doesn't necessarily want to touch all the time. And he just began to draw me into that. And it was interesting because in my run from God, I got a criminal justice degree because I was like, well, I want to be, you know, do investigations and CIA and all this other stuff that I had ideals about. That never happened.
Right.
But I think he was using that season to put me in this next season that didn't make sense for ministry. And so it just kept evolving that. And so I had an opportunity to work at the state. And then I got on with a private Christian agency. And that was something new to me. I was like, wait, there's like Christian nonprofits that do this work? Like, what does that look like? And so it just allowed me to expand my career on the foster care and adoption side. And it began to do more across Texas with the organization I was with, and everything was just pulling me in deeper. Every step was, hey, now you've removed kids. Now I'm going to put you in charge of placing a kid in a home. And now I'm going to put you in a place to love a kid in a home. And now I'm going to call you to go back to the church you've been running from and say, hey guys, why are we not doing this?
Right.
And so the first message I ever heard preached on the orphan was when I was 27 and I preached it.
Wow.
And I'd been in church my whole life. And I'm like, how are we missing this? Like, where did we go off the map and forget about these kids? So it's just that evolution and just favor of God within this space that he's given me opportunities and give me an opportunity to step into new leadership roles and new positions where he was just kept building me up to the place I am today, where I'm able to be the CEO and president of this nonprofit in Oklahoma that's doing amazing things. And I would say even now at 39, I'm still looking back at the steps and saying, wow, like when I was just being a punk and running or trying my best to hang out in the wilderness and not do what you asked me to do. You were preparing me each step of the way to bring me into the season to be a leader in this space. And so it's pretty incredible to just to watch the journey. It was his journey, not mine.
That is powerful. That's good stuff. I love it. Okay. So I definitely want to talk about Circle of Care and what you do now, but I think for the vast majority of people out there, they have no clue what it is, like what an investigator does, how that process, like even like having a kid come into foster care. I think they're like, people have no idea what that's like. Do you mind talking about like your time as an investigator and then in placement and what, just the ins and outs of the foster care system, I guess?
Yeah, absolutely, man. Something I always tell young workers, because there's a stigma, like, you, especially in this space, like nonprofit and the state both doing foster care, like, well, you want to go work for the nonprofit, the state's too tough. But I tell people all the time, man, that 18 months is the very reason I'm here today.
Interesting.
Like, it transformed my life in a lot of ways. And I would say it also prepared me to deal with any stress that comes my way as CEO. I can look back and be like, man, this is not stressful. Like, the days when I was an investigator, those are days when I thought, oh my gosh, will I survive? Right. And so for me, so what it would really look like as an investigator, we would have this hotline that would get the calls from around our counties. And it may be a teacher, maybe a parent, maybe a grandparent calling in and saying, hey, this abuse has occurred, or there's a suspected neglect. And we'd get this report. And I mean, the reports just came in all the time. It was not like one a week. We had teams of investigators that would be getting these reports weekly. And so, you know, it may say stuff like, you know, little Bobby supposedly was left at home alone by his parents. And so you're just rolling out to little Bobby's house. And it may be a trailer park in the middle of no man's land. It may be a gated community. And you're walking up and knocking on this door, really about to enter into a very tension-filled situation, right?
Yeah. Like,
no parent wants that knock. And so you're walking in that situation just trying to figure out, bring the tension down, because that isn't healthy investigation, but also really try to figure out what are the facts, you know, what's going on with the situation, specifically when it's abuse or sexual abuse and things like that. You want to walk through that. And so, you know, we were on call, and so we'd get calls in the middle of the night. We're walking into some rough areas at 3 a.m. in the morning, trying to determine if abuse or neglect occurred. We're walking into meth labs unintentionally sometimes. We have no idea, because that's not safe.
Right.
But you don't know that. The paperwork didn't say what's going on there. I remember one situation I walked into what I now know was a drug lab. At that point, I didn't know. I mean, I should have known. But I pulled up, and this house was in a pretty rough area of Waco. And it had a chain link fence, and there was two really ginormous pit bulls, probably the biggest pit bulls I've ever seen. And they're tied to chains on each side. And I had an intern with me, and I was like, bro, I don't know if I'm walking down that sidewalk. Those are big old dogs. He's like, oh, I think we got it. I was like, well, you go first. And if you make it, I'll follow. But somebody's got to call 911 if you don't make it.
Send the intern. Yeah. It's perfect.
And so this guy starts walking down the sidewalk, and these pit bulls are running and lunging. And about midair, that chain, like, it tightens and pulls him back. And I'm like, crap, he made it. Like, I got to do this now. And so I walk up, and we walk into this house, and it was a sad situation, some domestic violence going on. And that's really what the case was. And so we see this young mom and her baby. You can tell she's pretty scared, but not going to talk. And she has TVs all over her house. And I'm like, with cameras outside. And I'm like, what are all these TVs for? She's like, well, we raise pit bulls. I'm like, I just don't think that's the truth. Like, you may raise pit bulls, but, you know, within like 4 minutes, man, we hear these screeching brakes outside. And it's the boyfriend, and it's his house. And he is the largest dude I've ever seen. And he's angry. And so he basically threatens that he'll release the pit bulls on us if we don't get off his property. So we leave, and we follow up later. We do a lot with that case to get her out of that environment, get the baby out of the environment. But I remember calling the cops afterwards, like, hey, I was at this house. And they were like, we never go there without the SWAT team. Why did you go there?
Whoa.
I'm like, dude, what? Nobody told me that.
And so, that should be written down somewhere.
Yeah, the paperwork didn't say that. And so, yeah, so it's just a high-stress situation. But what I always tried to do, too, was – enter into the brokenness with the parent. And I don't know that that's always the case. Like, and the joke in my office was that Keith could remove your kid and then you would hug him. But I think that was the ministry side of where God was trying to do something through me, because I would tell the parent, like, hey, we're going to have to remove your kid. You know, whether you're on meth and you tested positive, or whether you're using cocaine, or whether, you know, there's some physical abuse where you got way excessive and we need to work through that anger. I would try to help them understand, like, this isn't the end of the story. Like, you can choose for this to be the end of the story. But what I hope is you're going to go and you're going to work hard, because this little kid needs you. They need you to love them. They need, I mean, every little kid I met, for the most part, almost 99% of the time, they love their mom and dad.
Yeah.
They just want the abuse to stop. They just want the neglect to stop. They want to be out of that environment. And so I tried to instill that in these parents, that, hey, you have a good shot now to come get your kid. And for me, you know, the hardest part was always when I removed a child and then I would drop that child off at a home, because I didn't know the home. I didn't know the family. I was just the investigator. And this kid would be like clinging to me, right?
Yeah.
And I was like, you're just going to leave me here? And I'm just like, oh my gosh. And I remember so many nights driving away, just praying, like, God, please let that be the right home for that kid, because I don't know.
Wow.
Like, I've done my job. Now I hand it off. And so, man, it was high intense. I think at that, I mean, it probably still is. At that point, it was the highest turnover position in the state of Texas.
Oh, for sure.
Just because you had so much coming your way. And I mean, there was one time I had 50 plus investigations going on.
What?
Yep. And so I just thought, like, I remember when I first started, people were like, oh, I'm on anxiety medication. I was like, man, what's wrong with you? Like, this is, right. You got this.
Right.
Man, by the end, I don't know how I wasn't on anxiety medication.
Yeah.
Because you would just lay in bed thinking, man, did I make the right decision? I can't find this boyfriend, or I can't find this mom. And should I have left the kid there? Should I not have left the kid there? Should I have removed the kid? And I remember just praying some nights, like, God, just stop my mind. Stop it.
Yeah.
And let me just rest for 7 hours before I have to get up and do this all again. So, man, it's intense. And you're right. I don't think people understand that. I don't think, you know, whether it's DHS in Oklahoma or what it is where you live, or any state human services agency, they get a lot of flack. You know, only the bad stories get posted when they miss something. But they don't understand. I mean, that's a 24-year-old, a 25-year-old, a 37-year-old. There's 30 of those investigations going on, or 20 or 50, whatever it may be.
Right.
And you're making big decisions with limited information sometimes.
Yeah.
And so such a tough place, man. Such a tough place. But like I said, I wouldn't change my career.
Yeah.
That was the ground in which God broke me. And really showed me, like, hey, this is where I'm going to keep you. And you see all these people that are hurting. You see all these moms and dads that haven't figured it out. And you see these kids who are being placed into a system. And you see a church that has kind of forgotten about it.
Yeah.
So I want to use you as this link to say, hey, wake up. God's on the move. And so I'm just blessed that he allowed me to be part of that movement with him.
Yeah. That's cool stuff, man. Thanks for sharing some of that. So you lived in Amarillo for a time, which I thought was the craziest thing ever, right? So did you go to Amarillo with the, were you a placement? Did you do placements in Amarillo? Is that?
Yeah. So I was part of the same placement agency. When I left the state, I joined a Christian agency in Texas called Arrow Child and Family Ministries. They moved me to Amarillo. We took over another nonprofit.
Okay.
And so again, just one of those situations where God continued to give me favor and give me opportunity. And so at 30, I was named one of the youngest directors over a regional area. And they picked me to move to Amarillo and flip another nonprofit that we were taking over. And so it was a whole new adventure.
Yeah.
I never supervised anybody. I'd never been in kind of that leadership role. And suddenly I had a whole organization that we had to flip in the panhandle of Texas.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy. So so, you know, after an investigation happens, what is the placement sort of situation? Like, how does that all transpire?
Yeah. So anytime a kid's removed, DHS or whatever organization, human services organization, is going to then follow their placement process, whatever that may be. It may be, they have to call a certain placement line, and that line calls all the child placing agencies. They may do it internally first, then push it out to the agencies. But really, they're looking at a situation of, all right, this is what we have, and and what homes are available in the local area. You usually want to go county first because you want to keep the kid close to home. But when homes aren't found there, then you start going outside the next closest region. And so you're just looking, you're just trying to figure out. And in some situations, it's easier. In other situations, you may end up going 5 hours across the state because the home just doesn't exist. And really how that plays out in foster care, younger kids are typically easier to place close to home. You have more capacity. But as you start to have the sibling groups, you start to have the teenagers, you start to have kids with special needs, those really become the harder placements where you may be spending multiple hours looking across an area, a region, a state, trying to determine which home it is. You know, perfect situation is that a state worker would have multiple homes to choose from, right?
Right.
And they say, all right, this is the best home. Unfortunately, a lot of times it's like, what homes do we have?
Right.
And then you're trying just to find a place for that child to go. And so then that worker will then have a home identified or a group home or some, in some cases, a shelter that takes kids in some states. And they'll know that they have to move that kid to that place. And they'll make that transition. For like me and Amarillo, we had a shelter. So we would see 200 plus kids a year come through our shelter.
What?
Because there just wasn't a home in the region. Oh, they could stay for 90 days. And typically what we saw is sibling groups and teenagers would come to our shelter. And it was just, it was really heartbreaking to see some of those kiddos. And more so when they got moved after 90 days, after our homes were identified, oftentimes the sibling group would be split.
Right.
You know, two go here, one goes there. And I always remember on those last days when they're about to make that move, they would just be like somewhat stunned. Maybe the younger ones are crying, like scared, like what happens next?
Yeah.
And I was like, man, this is just such an unfair place for these kids. They didn't choose this. You know, their parents chose this. And now we as a society are trying to band-aid this thing together sometimes, and it's not done well. And these kids just really kind of pay the price. And I would say even in that season of running a shelter, it's what really broke my wife and I's heart for adoption and foster care. Because there's another area that God had been knocking on my heart for like 8 years. And again, I was doing the key thing like, nope, look what I do. I do this and I do this and I do this. I do my part. I don't need to open my home.
Right.
And finally, I mean, he used the shelter situation just to break my heart for these kids and be like, man, Keith, do you really see this? Like, you're going to tell me you have an office space at your house or you have an extra bedroom, but you don't have room for these kids?
Yeah.
And so we ended up taking a sibling group of four that was placed in our shelter, actually.
Wow.
And we never wanted to do that. Like, we were totally telling God, like, hey, when we adopt, we want younger than our two biological daughters.
Yeah.
We preferably get a boy because we already have two girls. And he blew all that up. And we took kids out of birth order. We got three girls and a boy. We got diapers, even though we didn't want diapers. We got older kids. But it was that season of us just being in the midst of the brokenness and seeing what God was doing. And it got to a place where it was just going to be pure disobedience for me to say no.
Wow.
Like, I was going to have to look at God and say, you know what? I just disobey you. Hmm. Like, as my heavenly Father, I'm not going to obey you. And so for me, it was like, man, all right, I got to do it. I can't walk in disobedience with him like that. And so we said yes and took four kids as a placement into our own home. And so, yeah, that's what the placement process is, though, man. Just trying to find the right home and struggling to find the right homes at times and hoping it's the right situation for a kid.
Yeah. Gosh, you're killing me, man. That's like powerful stuff. I'm like, I appreciate you being willing to share about some of that stuff. So your four adopted kids are all biological siblings.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. That is just amazing.
Yeah, that's amazing. Pretty cool that to keep them all together.
Yeah. Well, because like you said, when you have kids who are in a shelter and in an environment and the sibling groups are split up, I mean, you've taken the last bit of stability that those kids have lives, right?
Yes. Like, just wrecked shop on their stability.
Right.
And I just feel like foster care, and it's not set up to do this, but unintentionally it re-penalizes and re-victimizes children.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that from my intentionally a safe way, but when you separate a sibling group, and it's no fault of the worker, I mean, we would love to have enough homes everywhere where no siblings would ever be separated.
Right.
But because they don't exist, it is kind of this re-victimization and penalization of these kids of like, you know, I think about our kids, kind of how they would probably have been broken up. They probably would have moved the two youngest girls into a home. My son probably would have been in his own home. And then our oldest daughter probably would have went to a home. And I just think to myself, like, man, what would that have looked like? Like, yeah, how heartbreaking that would have been for them. And would they have ever gotten back together?
Yeah.
You know, I look at our youngest. She was 20 months old. She was highly adoptable, right?
Yeah.
Like, right. Super cute, amazing. She's the one that everybody signs up for.
Yeah.
So I even think, would she have been adopted separately out and the other mm-hmm. three still be lingering in foster care? Like, what was the outcome of that, you know?
Yeah.
And no one would have known if I had been disobedient, right?
Right.
Like, that'd just be me and God. But these whole kids' stories would have been rewritten in some really dramatic, horrible ways, possibly.
Yeah.
And I would have just gone on with my life. And no one would have known.
Right.
And I think too many of us do that every day. We go on with our life. And you know, we just walk outside of what God's calling us to do. And we think we're the only one paying the consequence for that. But really, the consequence is for those that God was calling us to serve.
Yeah.
You know, what's the impact there, you know?
Right. Whew. Yeah, for sure. That's good stuff. I think there's some people probably listening to this podcast right now, like really upset with you.
Well, I'm upset with myself too.
the conviction, you know what I mean? So
yeah.
But I appreciate you being so transparent about that, because it really is like, it's so easy to just sort of push that stuff off, you know, and like, it's super inconvenient, right? Like,
yeah.
There's nothing convenient about foster care. You're going to, you know, visits, and you know, you're going through the court system, and
man, it's a life of inconvenience. But what I love about that though is when we look at scripture, right? Like, God calls us to inconvenience.
Yeah.
And I just don't think we preach that enough. Like, when we look, like, the disciples didn't sign up for convenience.
Yeah.
Like, when I read about the disciples, I'm like, y'all probably should have said no. Like, right. Y'all had a choice.
Yeah.
Y'all didn't even know. He hadn't even gone to the cross yet. You didn't know he was going to pull off the 3-day act.
Right.
Like, but you were like, we're in. And then once they saw it, they were like, all right, we're going to give our whole life for this thing. And I mean, I read that, I read what they do and how they live their lives. I mean, I'm challenged by that, because I mean, it's way easy to love Jesus and love convenience in our society.
Yeah.
And we try to make them one and the same. And that's, I don't know, man. I think he wrecks shop on that image if we allow him to.
Yeah. Amen. Yes. Amen. Good stuff. Well, I appreciate your passion, and I love that you're, you know, in this position now, like in Oklahoma running Circle of Care. Can you just talk about what your agency does a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So we've been around 100 years here in Oklahoma. We started out as an orphanage. And I love kind of how we started. It was a group of Methodist women who saw kids who were in need, right? And so what I think sometimes we typically do as a society, we say, hey, someone should do something about that.
Right.
And then we look around for the someone. Yeah. And instead, these women said, hey, we're the someone. And so they began to pray and gather their resources, and they launched this orphanage. And I remind my team about that story often, because I'm like, that's our very DNA. We're the someones. Like, we ain't looking for someone to come to our rescue. We're not looking for someone to come up with a solution. Like, we have to do it. That's the DNA of who we are. So that's how we launched. And for about 90 years of our history, we were very residential driven. So we had a children's home and a boys ranch, and we took private placements. About a decade ago, we started shifting more toward foster care. And so we flipped all of our campus into foster care communities where foster families can live in close proximity to each other if they want. Then they serve the kids who are in care. And then we've grown that across the state to include just people's individual homes. Okay. And so we're one of the top three foster care agencies in Oklahoma now, private-wise, that's serving and developing new homes, new opportunities for kids to have a great placement throughout the state. And that's our biggest program, and that's the program that really gets a lot of attention of what we do in Circle of Care. But for me, it's always about, again, that broken family, right? Like, yeah, we're going to serve these kids, but that's really kind of, that's the crisis, that's the emergency room of this work. Yeah. How do we get out on the front end prevention?
Right.
How do we begin to change generations? Hmm. And so for us, we have a program for single moms in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where we bring in up to 12 single moms at a time, plus their kids. And sometimes they come to us with one or two kids, but they still have a kid or two in foster care.
Okay.
So then we go all in trying to help them reunify. What do you need to get your kid back? How do we help you be a stronger mom, a healthier mom, so you get those kids? So we were just celebrating last week in one of our meetings. We had two moms who were reunified with some of their kids this last quarter.
Wow.
And we were just like, man, that's the win.
That is like, so big.
These moms are on our campus. Yeah. We got their kids back. And we were just, man, it was like church. We were just amening. And we were stoked to hear that because that's the plan. Like, let's keep kids out of foster care, or let's get them out and get them back with their mom. Yeah. And then love on these women to teach them. Because like in that program, last year when we ran some numbers, 66% of those women in our program had either been exposed to foster care as a kid,
right,
or they'd been exposed as a mom. Hmm. So these are just, man, hurting women,
yeah,
who need someone to guide them through that season and love on them and right, teach them how to relaunch. So that's a program we do there that's really more aimed at that prevention, and let's keep kids out of the system. And then we have a program for young adults, so the 18 to 24-year-olds who age out of the system,
yeah,
or kids who come from disadvantaged backgrounds. And we've just really kind of similar to the moms program, but just for that young adult. And our job is just to help them launch into society. And we're taking some swing at some of the statistics, like only 3% of kids who age out of foster care graduate college. Well, they do it because they don't have a support system. And so how do we help these kids get through college? And so that program has an educational and career goals that we kind of walk them through. And again, it's rewriting generations.
Yeah.
It's doing the work, the messy work of helping that young adult launch and not repeat the story, not repeat the cycle. And sometimes it's like riding a roller coaster with those young people.
Yeah.
Kids who age out of foster care, man, they're tired of people telling them what to do. They're frustrated. They're sometimes emotionally not where they need to be. And so, you know, we describe it as getting on the roller coaster with them and saying, hey, we got you. We're buckled in with you. And we're going to get to the end of this ride, and it's going to be good at the end, and we're going to get you to the destination. So I love both of those programs because I think those are doing the heavy work of let's keep kids out of the system.
Right.
Let's teach this young man who was in the system for 11 years that he can be a good dad and he can be a good husband someday, and he can have a career and have a new future and not have to see his kids come back into the system.
Right.
So that's the three main programs that we get the opportunity to interface with. And then we just launched a counseling program to do more mental health with our clients and then reach out to the communities as well. So that'll continue to build up in the next 12 months.
Yeah. Wow. That is that's amazing, because you're entering into, and we've already discussed this a little bit, but just entering into such a broken system, right?
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah,
it's hard. I mean, you're trying to do some like really messy work. And so,
Yeah,
I appreciate the, you know, just talking about like the prevention and the, you know, because these kids who have been in foster care are much more likely to have their kids in foster care.
Absolutely.
Right?
I mean,
And you keep talking about this generational thing. And that's
it is. It's just a generational cycle. And if someone doesn't stand in the gap and break the cycle, it's just going to continue.
Yeah.
It rarely stops on its own. And so, how do we love on those individuals? How do we surround them? How do we support them? You know, and I think that's a whole other piece, like the church we miss sometimes. Because we love to talk about foster care even more now today than probably we did a decade ago.
Yeah, definitely.
Because it's the kid, and we're going to love this kid. But what about the mom and dad who lost their kid?
Yep.
Like, don't you think Jesus is pursuing them harder than anyone right now in the darkness?
Yeah.
And we as a church, I think we forget that because we demonize that individual.
Yeah.
Like, oh, well, you're the one who, you know, we have all of our opinions on why, but like with the single moms program, that 23-year-old who lost her kid to care was the 12-year-old who went into care.
Right.
So she's just repeating what she knows. And so how do we rescue her from that? And it isn't us, but how are we part of the rescue that God's doing if we're a willing participant and we're obedient to that?
Yeah. I mean, it's like there's a no-brainer. It's like, yes, of course we are called to step in right here, right? Like, of course. There's not like, we don't need to like open the scriptures and be like, well, here are my proof texts for this. It's like, of course God wants families reunified. I mean, Yeah,
absolutely.
Well, because there's this thing that's happened. I mean, it's happened for a long time in Christianity, but where we put ourselves in the adoption and foster care world as the saviors, right? So we're coming in, we're going to rescue these kids. Yeah. And then even in foster care, we have this notion that like we're fostering to adopt, which is not the point of the foster care system and actually kind of dangerous.
Yeah.
Honestly. Yep. Do you mind talking just a little bit about some of that?
Yeah, man. I think going back to your very first point that God is all about family reunification, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So plan A was that family.
Right.
Like we can all agree, we should be able to agree that that was plan A. And when that got off track and that got broken, just like our plan A got broken in the garden.
Yeah.
And all hell broke loose and the disruption broke loose.
Yeah.
That's happening for that family. So plan A was that. And so if that's what it is, how are we not wrapping around that individual? How are we not engaging and pursuing that? But I think you're right. What happens is we almost like dehumanize that individual.
Right.
And we're like, well, it's the kid. It's all about the kid. So it's easier for us to engage this mindset of, well, I want to foster, but I don't want to hurt if that kid goes back. And I don't want to rehumanize this biological parent, because if I do that, maybe I would love them. Maybe my heart would be broken for them. Maybe I would pursue them more. And that just seems messy.
Yeah.
And so if I can dehumanize them and love the kid and be the defender of the kid, then it just becomes easier, I think, for our own self-sustaining and our own selfishness. Not to be harsh, but I mean, that's what happens. And so within this space, you're right. Foster care was never created to be a system through which we create adoptions.
Right.
It was created to be a system through which we temporarily protect a child while we help the parent get back on their feet. And unfortunately, because it's so big and so many kids languish in this system, and as you said, it's a broken system.
Yeah.
It has that opportunity where parents are able to I don't want to say manipulate at times, but somewhat not really help the biological family relaunch.
Right.
And then they get the kid.
Yeah.
So it happens. And at the same time, there's also room for adoption in some instances. We know 100,000 kids today need to be adopted.
Right. Yes.
You know,
very much so.
But again, those kids don't necessarily fit our perfect story either.
Yeah.
And so it's almost like maybe we dehumanize those kids too. We're like, well, someone else should take that 17-year-old kid who's been in 17 placements. That's not what God's called me to do.
Right.
And I'm like, man, but is he not? Like, what is he calling us to do? How do we engage that? So we adopt when it's convenient, but we don't adopt when it's inconvenient, right? Back to inconvenience.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so when we take the young kid, we're like, oh, we got this, but we forget about the 100,000 that are sitting there today thinking, man, will anybody ever want me? And what a thought, right? Like what a thought as believers and followers of Christ to think that there's kids out there thinking, does anyone want me?
Right.
Like, I mean, that's harsh, you know?
Yeah.
And to know that we have a God who pursues us and wants us, and we're not able to take that to them sometimes. So, yeah, I mean, definitely the goal always is reunification first.
Yeah.
But I think sometimes we have to rehumanize that biological family so we can pursue them.
Yeah. Isn't it amazing? It's just amazing how quickly to me we can totally write somebody off because they're sinners. Mm. Like, you know, it's like, what?
Yeah.
How do we believe in a gospel that like cancels our sin, you know, that forgives us. And then we can't forgive somebody else for their sins, you know?
Oh yeah, we do, man. We do. We write them off as hopeless and lost and, you know, their sin is too great. And, you know, we're a society of at leasters, man. We like to say, well, at least I didn't do that.
Right.
Yes, I sinned and God forgave me, but at least I didn't do what that person did.
Right.
And, you're right, man. It's so crazy that we do that.
Okay. So, how do we talk to the church? How do we talk to Christians about like how to go about doing this sort of kingdom work?
Yeah. I mean, you know, as I think about like the church and Christians, what I love about this is even though maybe we've been inactive in this space at times individually and as humans, God's never been asleep on this issue.
Right.
And so I've always like approached the church and approached the body of Christ is, we just need to remind and maybe reawaken the DNA.
Yeah.
Like if we're adopted kids of God, like adoption's his heart, if we were orphans and we were outcasts and he pursued us in our brokenness,
yeah,
then that's who we are, right? And so it's our DNA to be the pursuers. And I think for a long time, we've forgotten our DNA, man. We've forgotten who our daddy is, right?
Yeah.
And so for me, I always kind of start there, like, this is who he is. If this is who he is, how do we begin to mimic that? And I think even in my own life, I think about my own father, right? Like, there's things my dad does and he did when I was growing up that I thought, man, I would never do that.
Right.
Like, why does he do that? And now that I'm 39, like, I mimic some of those behaviors.
Right.
Like, even the silly things he did. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is him. This is totally him.
Right.
Well, I want the same thing for the church. I want the same thing for us as the body of believers. We should mimic our father. Like, we should find us in the midst of brokenness and be like, oh my gosh, this is totally God. This is totally our dad. This is why we're here. And so for me, I think you start there. You start with pointing it back toward who's our father. Hmm. And what does he look like? What are his characteristics? What does his DNA look like? And if we say we are now heirs of his kingdom and we are his kids, we naturally will start to mimic that, right? And so begin to expose them to that. But I think it is dangerous if we just expose them to the front end of foster care.
Yeah.
Because then it becomes about the kid and only about the kid. And we forget about that biological family.
Yeah.
So I think you really have to start talking about, like, what's God's plan for a family? What's God's plan for redemption and salvation for people who are broken? And that includes the mom and dad who lost their kid.
Right.
And how do we pursue them in that? And so, and I think it's baby steps. We are risk adverse as Christians sometimes.
Yeah.
And we love things that we can send a check to, and we can do a little bit of, you know, $25 here. We can buy a cool t-shirt. We don't really know that we want to jump off the deep end and actually do the messy work. And so I think also it's creating opportunities for people to be exposed, but not be overly intimidated, right?
Yeah.
And so opportunities within the local community. Maybe there's an agency who serves birth moms like ours, the Single Mom Program. That's a great place for them to start to interact and realize, like, man, she's just a 21-year-old kid who needs love. And so it really starts to humanize that person. And then we can start to move toward, like, well, there also is foster care. And how do we get homes for these kids? And why that's a role of the church, obviously, to do that. But it really is baby steps. And I think also it's prayer. You know, there's so many pastors and individuals and leadership within churches who don't engage this. And I don't know the reason. I don't know if it's just because they feel like if I haven't done it, I can't preach it, or they're just a lack of education. And so maybe our part's just educating them.
Right.
But I think it's also just praying for a movement of the Holy Spirit. Like, if this is who God is, we just need him to reawaken the church to it and wake us back up to his DNA and who he is. You know, we've done this throughout our history. And that's one of the things, like, when I look at, like, our organization's been around 100 years, but there's other organizations that have been around way longer than us.
Yeah.
And sometimes in the secular media and the world, there's this whole, like, should nonprofit faith-based agencies play a role? And I'm like, what do you mean should we play a role?
Right.
Like, we've shown up before everybody else showed up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, we just happened to go silent when the state started doing it about 50 or 60 years ago. We're like, oh, okay. Well, someone else did it. Right. And we kind of took a back seat. Mm. But this has always been our car. We've always been driving on this highway of saving and chasing and pursuing and allowing God to use us in his rescue for these kids. So when I hear organizations talk about, well, we don't know if faith-based should play a role, it's like, we were the only ones in this space for years.
Right.
Because the gospel called us to this.
Yeah.
And so, but I think we have, the more the state and the government's got involved, it's been easier for the church to say, well, they're the someones who will fix this. Yeah. When we were used to being the someones in the past.
Yeah.
And so we just got to remind ourselves of who we are and follow our dad.
Yeah. Dude, such good stuff. I love it. I love it. I appreciate you talking about that. Let's get into the nitty gritty though of being a CEO of a foster care agency. Cause I would imagine there's a little bit of a learning curve that comes with some of that. So what has that been like? How long have you been the CEO?
Just over a year.
A year.
About 14 months or so.
Okay. So how has that transition gone? What's the learning curve been like for you?
Yeah, it's gone pretty well. The learning curve definitely is there. There's a lot of things that, I had never done or been exposed to that I've had to do now. And just the amount of questions that come at you, you know, that you just never knew you had to answer.
Yeah, sure.
You know, everybody's looking like, well, that's the leader. Like, let's figure out. And so for me, I think how I've transitioned through the learning curve, though, is really focusing on culture, like building a healthy culture. And that's something that I'd been dreaming about since I was 24 and I first started in this space. Child welfare in general chews people up and spits them out.
Yes.
And so for me as a CEO, I feel like my greatest role is to take care of my people so then they can do the hard work of taking care of others.
Yeah.
But if I'm not taking care of them, I failed them in this organization. So I think it's one of the exciting things for me when I got this role is like, all right, man, I finally get the opportunity to figure out how do we love our people well? How do we support them well? How do we make this the healthy environment? So we've spent a lot just learning and talking about our culture and how we're going to do things as an organization. What are our core values? So that's been a learning experience for me, but it was also years of dreaming that was finally able to come out and put it on paper because I had seen how things had been done that I was like, man, we could take care of people better than this. And now I get the opportunity. And so it's really kind of getting in that space to do it. So yeah, it's challenging. I mean, you have wild things happen that you don't, you know, you think you're doing a good job and you'll make one donor mad about something. And so you'll get a random one-off phone call, like you've ruined their whole world and you have no idea why you ruined their world. Right. And so you're trying to figure that out. And you have the challenge of just, I think the responsibility, you know, I feel a strong responsibility for my people. And so I want to make strong business decisions as well. Yeah. Like I think nonprofits, sometimes it's all heart, no business. And I think you have to have both to do it well. Yeah. I mean, and so for me, it's always making sure that we lead with our heart and we love our people well, but also we're making smart, wise decisions that put us in the best position because there's, you know, multiple staff that are counting on this organization to take care of them and their family.
Yeah.
And so there's a strong responsibility toward that. And so walking through that's been good. And then we had a unique situation. We had a CEO who stayed on for about 8 months as a kind of a president emeritus.
Okay.
And so I had someone that I could run some ideals by. I think the challenging in that is I had totally different ideals than him sometimes.
Right.
And yeah. So kind of feeling comfortable in my own space, even though he was still around.
Yeah.
To say, we're going to do this totally different than you did.
Yeah.
But I think that's part of just leadership. Like if you get into a place of leadership, believe in yourself because others believed in you. Right. And so I constantly have told myself that since day one, even through the interview, like my whole prayer through the interview was, God, I just want the best CEO and that may not be me.
Right.
So just help me come out of this interview knowing I did everything I could.
Yeah.
Because that's all I want. And so every interview I had leading up to this role, I felt totally confident as I walked out. And it wasn't confident that I was going to get the job. It was confident that I was the best version of me.
Right. Because
that's all God calls me to be in that moment, you know? And so once I got the role, then I had to trust that I'm still the best version of me.
Yeah.
That he's built me up and he's created me for this season. And trust that because especially in leadership, man, it's lonely. And you can get in these spaces where you just can't bounce ideals off everybody.
Yeah.
And then negative self-talk can creep in and be like, oh, man, is this going to mess up the whole organization? Are you making the right decision? And so I think even being in a CEO role, I don't think I understood that as much until I got in this position.
Sure.
The loneliness that comes with it and the weight you carry. So I've had to work through some of that over the last year, too, just trying to figure out what does that look like and how do I process those emotions in a healthy way. And so that's been a challenge, but it's been good. It's really stretched me and grown me. So it's been fun, though. I mean, I think God had been preparing me for this, and I had been preparing myself for this season for about a decade.
Wow.
So that preparation now gets to play out. Not that I do everything right.
Right.
But it's definitely fun and energizing and challenging to get to take an organization and lead us to the best place we can be. And not just the organization, but again, it goes back to people. I want our people to be the best versions of themselves because they've worked here.
Yeah.
And so that's part of our culture. And we talk a lot about that. And how do we build up our people? How do we engage them? How do we, you know, just help them, you know, be the best version of them. because that makes everybody better in this organization.
Yeah. So how do you go about doing that? Supporting, you know, some of those, what are some of the things y'all have come up with to, you know, better support workers in this space?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think we've really created a family friendly environment and an environment that has the flexibility to understand like, hey, if you have to be out late, like we want you to come in, we want you to come in late. We want you to spend some time regrouping. And also just, it starts from the top down because I can tend to be a workaholic and I know that about myself. And so even me being intentional about taking my vacation and signing off for a week, it begins to create some of that culture that it's okay to take a vacation and sign off for a week.
Oh, that's good.
And so we encourage people like, hey, you're on vacation. Don't answer your phone. Hey, you're on vacation. Turn your phone off. We've created an on-call system to where all of our caseworkers, except the one that's on call, can turn their phones off.
Wow.
And we just want them to be able to turn off when they walk out the door. Hmm. And so if they're not on call that week, they don't have to think about it after they leave at 5. I mean, not that you won't, but you're not pulled back into it. So we're doing that. We create a committee that really focuses in on some of the energy and the fun activities we want to do as an organization to connect our people. And so they're working out some different things we're going to do in the next 12 months, family picnics and the way we do our Christmas parties and bringing our team together and loving on them are some things like that that we're working through, that will roll out. And I think then it's also just seeing the people as people and not cogs in a wheel.
Sure.
Right. And so for me, every person who chooses to come to this organization has value. Hmm. And so from day one, I use the language with them that thank you for choosing to work for us. That you had a lot of options and you chose us. And so it's not so much I chose them, but they likewise chose me. And so we talk through a lot about that. You know, something we're launching here in the fall is a leadership deal that we're going to bring in frontline workers that have leadership potential. And I'm going to take them through 9 to 12 months of leadership development. And I know we're a small organization, so we probably won't have the up chain for all those people to eventually move into a role. Yeah. But my heart really is let's develop leaders in this organization that even if they leave us, they're going to go lead other organizations well, and it's because they were here.
Yeah.
And so if we develop leaders who run multiple nonprofits throughout Oklahoma City, then that's a win.
Yeah.
You know, and not just saying, well, we're going to hold on to our people. No, we're going to create the best version of them. Hmm. And if they choose to leave because it's a better opportunity for them, we're going to pat them on the back and high five them and cheer them on. And we're still going to be here to answer their questions when they need help.
Right.
And they move into that role. So at the core, it's just valuing people for being people. And again, like child welfare, I think we just think, well, we'll go find another case manager. Or we'll go find another worker. Or this is just stressful work.
Right.
It is stressful. So how do we begin to take that off? How do we begin to say, hey, we honor you and your family and not just the job you do for us?
Yeah.
And so we do a lot around that and just the language we use and the way the flexibility and the love we give our people because we want this to be a great place.
Wow. That's cool. As somebody who, my wife was a foster care worker for a time, she's a social worker. And so as somebody who's watched my wife get chewed up and spit out at a lot of agencies, you know, that is, just so valuable. It's amazing. It's amazing how poorly run a lot of nonprofits can just be. I mean,
absolutely, man.
So
there's a huge leadership gap in the nonprofit world. And I would say the church world.
Yeah.
Like we don't focus on leadership and development and, it's sad.
Yeah.
You see it again and again and again in this space. And that's why my desires, my dreams, my heartbeat is to figure out how to develop great leaders in nonprofit.
Right.
Because this space needs great leaders.
Yeah.
Because it's been lacking at times. You're right.
Yeah, totally. Totally. Well, when you write the book, I'm reading it. So you already got a sale. You know?
All right. One sale. We did.
That's great stuff, man. I appreciate all that. I appreciate what y'all are doing. It's inspiring. So
thanks.
It's awesome. That. Yeah. I'm so glad we got to connect at KFO and,
yeah, it was so cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just awesome. Random, but that was awesome that we got to make the connection.
For sure, man. All right. Well, you ready to jump into the final two questions?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. All right. So my first question for you is, what is the strangest job that you have ever had?
Strangest job I have ever had. I would say like the job I had that I never realized I never wanted to do again. When I was a teenager, I was on a roofing crew.
Oh,
and it was the summertime in Oklahoma. And I think that was really the eye-opening point. Like, this is not worth it. I don't care how much money I make. And so as a teenager, I was making a ton of jobs. But my job in that was not to actually do the roof. My job was kind of the grunt work.
Yeah, right.
Because I was just hauling the stuff. And so for me, it was just like, this is not okay.
Yeah.
And I don't ever want to do this. I'm thankful for people who roof. And I'm thankful that I can hire those people.
Right.
But I decided at 16, when I was the grunt of that crew, that this is not okay. So.
That's good. Checking stuff off the box, man. At least you know, right?
I know. That's not what
I'm doing. Right. That's good. Okay, so then my final question would be, what is one piece of advice you would give to somebody looking to bring the kingdom of God more into their work?
Yeah, I think the advice I would give for someone looking to do that is let God lead. I think so many times in my career when I haven't been connected to him, or I try to run out ahead of him because I think I'm the smarter one.
Yeah.
It ends miserably. And so for me, what I always try to do is daily put the perspective, even with this agency, daily, I hand it back to God.
Yeah.
Daily, like when I'm driving to work in the morning, I just say, you know what, God, this is not my agency. It's always been your agency. You just allow me to be a part of it.
Yeah.
And so I just need you to lead. And so for me, and whether that's anything we do, whether it's we're an attorney and we're gonna go write court dockets today, whether it's, man, we're at a burger shop flipping burgers, whether we're mowing a lawn, I think if we remember that, hey, this is all God's and he's the leader and he's the guide in all of this, it allows us to really kind of get a different perspective as we move through it. And so that's kind of reshaped and reframed my mind. Because again, kind of that workaholic personality is, I'm a doer. I'm gonna go get it done, and I'm gonna push through these obstacles, and I'm gonna crush these goals. And it doesn't work that way when I forget that.
Yeah.
I let God go out before me, and follow Him where He's moving, and just kind of watch what He's doing.
Right.
And allow myself to be a part of that. So I think ultimately every day, no matter what your job is, because sometimes people say, "Well, I don't have a ministry job." We all have ministry jobs.
Right.
God has uniquely crafted us. Created us and given us talents and gifts to glorify and exemplify and again mimic our Father.
Yeah.
No matter where we're at. And so when we remember that and we let Him go out before us, we get to follow Him in that, no matter what environment we're in. So for me, that's daily. I just have to remind myself, like, hey, this is God's. Here we go. What do you got for me today, God? I just want to follow. I don't want to get out ahead of you.
Yeah. It's good stuff, man. That's great stuff.
Yeah.
I appreciate it. Thanks so much for coming on and hanging out with
thanks,
me a little bit.
Hey, thanks, man. I love you. Love this podcast. Love everything you're doing. So
appreciate
thanks
it,
for man. Inviting me. I'm glad we crossed paths in Kentucky.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt.
Yeah.
All right. We'll talk to you soon.
All right, buddy. Take care.
See ya. Well, I hope you enjoyed hearing from Keith and just hearing his heart behind why he does what he does. It's beautiful how God just orchestrated his story to do what he does right now and do it really well. And I think with excellence, and that's just amazing. It's a need, and it's awesome to hear about all that. Be sure and check out Circle of Care. I have all the links there in the show notes. Check them out and give them a like. Make sure you're following what they got going on. It's amazing stuff always being built there. So you want to stay up to date with what they got going on. And until next time, get out there and hustle.